I have spent plenty of time this week thinking through three questions that I asked you to think through as well. I had a jump on you, I have to confess, because I thought these through in preparation for my comments last week. So they weren't new to me last Sunday. Sunday was merely a continuation of them. They came out of 1 Corinthians 4:7, if you weren't here with us. Who makes you different than anyone else was the first of those questions. Well, that probably had a lot of people thinking for a fair amount of time. Who makes me different? If there is a difference, well, it's really only God. If I've got more talent or more gifting or more whatever than another person, it's not me, it's God. Because the second question came along, what do you have that you did not receive? That kind of gets really to the core of it. And remember, we took a little inventory here, but then I suggested you go away and really take a good, solid look at all that you are and all that you have. And then test it against that question, 1 Corinthians 4:7. What do you have that you did not receive? And hopefully your answer came up as mine did. Not a stinking thing. Now, you may not use stinking in your response, but nothing. I got nothing. I really have nothing on my page after I acknowledge that it's all been given to me. The third question, of course, why then do you boast as though you did not? That's the question that haunts us, because some of us, we know we received it. Whatever it happens, we know it is ours because it was given to us. But for some, there's still that sense of, But there's that little piece of us that says, I really had a part in this in the first place. Why do you boast as though you did not receive it? The answer, of course, is pride. Pride is what makes me want to take and claim credit for the home I live in. I built it. I worked for it. All that kind of prideful nonsense. Why did you get the job you've got? Well, because I sold myself. Really, really. And on, the audacity comes out in that series of questions. I hope you've looked at your list often this week. That was my suggestion last week, and it was one that I think will yield good fruit in our lives, in your life and in my life. And I hope you've concluded correctly when it was all said and done, and maybe you're doing so right now, that everything I have and everything more personally that I am, that's identity stuff. That's the core Steve stuff. Everything I got, everything I am, is a gift from God. That's the correct conclusion. And that one fits all of us. And by the way, while you're making your list, I hope you've included the most valuable gift of all. Salvation. It trumps everything. It supersedes everything we could come up with, because it too is a gift that was received. There's never been an exception to it. There's never been anyone arrive in heaven with their hand out saying, God, look, I did my part. Payday. I'm here to get what I've got coming to me. You don't want to go to heaven with that kind of tone. Not that you would. But because the clear reality is, you really want what you got coming? It wouldn't be here. This would not be home for you if that's the case. Now, that's harsh, I realize, but it's true. Salvation is a gift we receive. Your salvation and mine came at an incredible personal cost to Jesus Christ. What's that? What cost? His life. His own life. And just before giving his life on that, remember that gruesome turn, Good Friday, what we looked at just recently, he had a meal with his closest followers while the gruesome part was still unfolding that night. They were arresting him in moments. They would try him overnight, and then they would take him and nail him to a cross It's not Jesus saying, here, let me pay for them. That doesn't cost. Not when you're comparing it to your own life. Jesus wasn't saying, you know, look, let me take the debt Steve has racked up, and because I got a lot of money, tell me the bill, tell me the damage. Here, let me write it. Who can't write a check? We're talking a cross. It was on that very night that Jesus, gathering with his men, said, every time you share communion, which, as they pushed back from the table, apparently there was some bread and there was some wine left. And he says, I want you to remember these two things are telling a story about me. So every time you take them, every time until I come back and we share them again in glory or in heaven, that includes what we're about to do this morning. Every time you do this, I want you to remember me. And here's what I want you to remember. I want you to remember that the salvation you claim, the salvation you possess, came as a gift from me. It's not a result of your virtue. It's not a consequence of your, progressive improvement plan. It's a gift that I give to you. I'm going to ask the servers to come join me at this time because we're going to serve communion in that spirit. To have you take and hold in your hand the bread and the cup, which is kind of how we do things on communion Sundays. But I want you to, this time, just go back a little bit of time and remember. Remember what Jesus said. Holding up a piece of bread, I want you to remember me. And I want you to remember that what you have in your hand, but more importantly, what you have in your heart, salvation, is a gift that I give to you. So take that and hold it in your hand until everybody's served, and then we'll share it together this morning. He said, every time you share communion, remember me. It occurs to me that some, maybe most of us, have added salvation to the list of things that we've received, but there may be some in this gathering that have never done that. You have a different view of things. The Bible makes it very clear that salvation is not something that is gradual. It is sudden. It is a moment of belief where you say, and maybe you need to say right now, Jesus, I believe you died, and my only hope for salvation is you. I receive your gift of salvation. Take this now, and if you've already become a Christian some time ago, take this as an expression of gratitude that the very thing you possess, salvation, truly is a gift that you've received. I imagined Jesus on the cross looking down at me saying, you know, I love you. That's why I'm here for you. That's why I took your place. As you and I share the cup, remember what you and I have. Salvation is a gift we've received. Worship Him. I want to tell you a single verse in the New Testament that has been a verse of inspiration that makes me want to aspire. In my own personal life, it makes me want to become the things that I read in this single verse. It's a verse in Acts chapter 4, verse 13. Whether you turn there or not, that's fine. I hope it becomes something of a kind of a compelling scripture for your life as well. Don't have a page number, but essentially what had happened is Peter and John stood out from the crowd. They had preached a sermon. They were going for it. They pulled out all the stops, we would say. They laid it on the line, and as they did so, many in the crowd knew who they were. They knew them not to be these bold, strong, courageous men of deep and compelling conviction. No, not at all. They knew them as kind of simple guys. They knew them as, well, fishermen. Guys that just kind of count fish at the end of the day and determine was it a good day or bad, or that it wasn't complicated. But Acts 4:13 said, when the crowd saw the courage of these two, Peter and John, and realized that they were unschooled, they didn't go to seminary. They probably didn't graduate from high school. They didn't have credentials like we tend to gather and collect today. They were ordinary men, it goes on to say. That left an impression. In fact, the word is astonished. These people were astonished, and they took note. They made a mental note of this fact. Those two had been with Jesus. Wouldn't you like that to be said of you? I don't care where you work. Wouldn't it be something at the end of the day, as you're walking toward your car, somebody's looking out the window of your office or business or something, and they're noticing you leave, and they're thinking, she's been with Jesus. Isn't that good? Students, you go to school. Wouldn't it be something that, you know, I was known for other things when I was in school. It wasn't what I'm telling you right now. Don't get me started. I was known for a clown. He's horsing around. Detention. How much detention can a guy graduate with? You know, that kind of thing. I was not known for what I'm telling you right now, but wouldn't it be inspiring and exciting for you if that became the thing you were known for? You know, he's been with Jesus. It shows. Look at their life. You see, that's how it's supposed to be. I think... Ready for a shocker? For every follower of Christ. So people go, whoa. Wow. That gal's been with Jesus. That guy's been with Jesus. I'm blown away. You see, meeting God should make a difference. Just as trusting in Jesus should transform our lives. We've used the expression, you turned. You're cruising along this way. You trust Jesus. Whoosh, and he sets you on a new course. And people go, wow, that person's been with Jesus. So my question this morning, have you met God? I don't just mean in this moment of communion, but have you met God and trusted in Jesus? If so, it's an appropriate follow-up. Has it changed you? If not, you should be at least curious and hopefully somewhat concerned. I want to show you two quick stories and then invite two people up, three people up to share with you something of their own personal experience. I want you to go to the first book of the Bible for a second. I want you to look at the story of Abram. It's in Genesis chapter 12, just three verses here. Genesis chapter 12 is on page 8, okay? So you can see from the page number, the Bible's just getting started here. Let me show you what I'm talking about here. Abram lived in the land of idolatry, known as Ur of the Chaldeans. Most of the folks that lived in the city, that we would call them city dwellers, were worshipers of a moon god, small g, named Nanar. This was the god they sacrificed to and lived for. Abram, at this time in his life, Genesis 12, did not know God. You need to know this, too, also about Abram. He is 75 years old at this point. All right? That's kind of enough bio on him. 75 years old, does not know God at this point, lives in a city of pretty much unchristian people, we would say. Folks that are chasing after a moon god, whatever that is. All right? And it's into that that Abram hears from heaven. Look on as I read. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your country." This is what he hears from heaven. "Your people and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Now keep your eyes on the page, because the next three words sum up what this encounter meant to Abram. You're looking at verse 4? Because they're the three words that sum up his response to hearing from God in heaven. Abram left. So Abram left. There it is. Age wasn't an obstacle. I told you he's 75 years old. He left. Experience wasn't an issue. Obedience for Abram was the issue. So when God said at the beginning of this, very first words out of God's mouth, verse 1, leave your country. When God said leave your country, the only legitimate answer for Abram was what verse 4 tells us. So Abram left. There it is. We make it complicated, don't we? That's it. That's the story. So in response to God saying go, Abram says, okay, I'll go. So is your response as immediate? That's a good question. Let's try it on for a sec. God says go. You say, finish the sentence. Go where? That's a good one. So I'm to go where? Some would say, ho-ho, slow. Got a job, got a home, kids in school, things to do. Our list, your list is like my list. I got bills to pay. Or some will say, you may not say it out loud in a gathering like this. No. God says, go. We say no. Remember what I'm sort of building on this morning. Meeting with God should make a difference for you. Now, I want you to jump from this scene to the second scene and the last scene here. In the New Testament, all the way over, jump to the scene that's unforgettable on the night of Jesus' resurrection. We think it's, by the way, it's in John chapter 20, okay? So find your way clear over to John chapter 20, page 769. We pay a lot of attention to the morning of Jesus' resurrection. We call that Easter. We celebrated it just 2 weeks ago, two Sundays ago. But John 20 takes place on the night of his resurrection. It was nightfall. Big day, we would all say, by any account. It's nightfall, though. I want you for a moment to transport yourself to a private, quiet, most likely secret room. It is closed, and it is a close-in gathering, not a big, giant ballroom. It's a tight little area, and it's locked. And it's locked for a reason. This has been a big day. Something happened today that has never happened before, and you still don't understand it. You've just learned, in fact, thanks to a firsthand report from Mary Magdalene, who ran all the way from the empty tomb. She has come with some news, winded. She's trying to catch her breath as she's relating what has just happened. Jesus is alive, and the reason I say that is because I saw him. Not passing on hearsay, someone told me along the way, it's I saw him. That's the kind of almost near panic spirit that's there. You can't quite get your mind around this report. You're studying the eyes in the room, wondering, are you the only one that just finds this, it's incredulous. You just go, what? It can't be. I saw him die. He hung from a cross. He breathed his last. He slumped his head. Everything. And that painful memory comes rushing to your mind. Then just as you're scratching your head, and you're saying to yourself, you don't say it out loud, you don't want to hurt her feelings, but she's losing it. Mary, you're over the top. You're this is a break from reality. Along with that, you're thinking, who took him? Okay, I grant he's gone, but who took him? And where have they taken him? All of those questions are kind of coursing through your mind. And there suddenly, Jesus is standing in the room. Right in front of you. Verse 19. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit." You see, you can't deny it. You're seeing him with your own eyes. You're hearing him with your own ears. You're reaching out and touching him with your own hands. And he says to you two times, probably, as I think of it, because I need to hear it. He says in verse 19, "Peace be with you." He repeats himself again in verse 21, "Peace be with you." And then what he says next, you can't shake. Even if you wanted to, you have not been able to forget these words ever since you heard them. They are stuck inside you. Verse 21, "As the Father has sent me, so I send you." You know it. It's not real common, but your life that very moment is being changed. Like Abram, you've just seen Jesus, and the transformation has already begun to take place. And your ears that very moment begin to ring with those 10 transforming words. "As the Father has sent me, so I send you." He's not looking at any single person in the room. He's looking at every single person in the room. Every. So do you go? Let's bring it to today. Have you gone? Will you go? You know, to be fair, to be sure, not everyone responded like Abram back in Genesis 12, though we should. Even two who had traveled with Jesus, that's a pretty special group. Exclusive group, weren't quick to go. In fact, they held up. One is not even in this gathering. He shows up right after what I just read. His name's Thomas. He was the doubter. He You can almost hear, you can almost let your mind imagine the look on his face as he says in verse, drop down to verse 25, they give him the news, we have seen the Lord. And he says to them, can you just imagine him doing this? Nope. Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and my hand in his side, no way, no how, I won't believe. Can you just picture that? Might work for you. Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, make a judgment about what you think you saw yesterday, but until, that's how it would be. That was Thomas. He was the doubter. There was one in that room, though, that night. He was Peter, the denier. Picture Peter when Jesus comes into the room, says twice, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you. What do you picture on Peter's face? I don't even see Peter's face. I picture Peter going like this, looking up every so often, but at all costs, avoiding eye contact. Because the most fresh memory for you is you failed him. You denied ever knowing him. You heard that dreadful animal crow at night. And you can't shake it. It haunts you. But to both of them, to both Thomas, the doubter, and Peter, the denier, and to you and to me, the same appeal is made. I am sending you. Let me bring it to us. Many in this room have met Jesus Christ. It may have been a long time ago. Some of you will go back years to recall that day when suddenly you met Christ. But some, it may be just recently. Maybe if you prayed just this morning, come into my life, Lord Jesus. But in any case, it either should show or should start to show. So does it. If I'm reading this right, verse 21, you and me are both of the sent community. We are part of the sent community. Sent where is a good question. And the answer to that question is as there are as many answers as there are schools and jobs and neighborhoods and families gathered in this place. That's the answer to that question. Sent where? Sent to Conestoga. Sent to Tigard High School. Sent to Tualatin. Sent to IBM. Sent to pick your place of business. Costco. Wherever you work. Sent to Luke Lane, where I live. Sent. One family here at Grace Point, the Duskin family, are a family who have said in response to this, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. They have responded by saying, okay, God, we'll go. You need to know this about them before they share briefly. They're a normal family. He's a corporate project manager. She, a mother of three. A wife and a mother of three. I asked Greg and Carol this morning to share. And Greg's going to tell you about a time, though his story, I should warn you, could take hours and hours. We would have church like they do in Latin America if I let Greg really get carried away here. Because it's so involved and so fascinating to hear. But I asked him to kind of close in on driving in a car or somewhere around then when he realized the answer to last week's question, what do you have that you did not receive? The answer to that question is really nothing. That caused him way back then to take inventory. My job, my kids, my wife, my money, my future, my life. It's all been given by God to me, to us, to manage. And God said, now that you got that straight, Greg, Carol, I'm going to send you with your kids. And they said, okay, we'll go. Greg, Carol, come on up. Would you... And just occurs to me, I don't think, oh, there's a microphone right there. Hey.
Thanks for coming, y'all. Carol, by the way, oftentimes you'll hear her back in the back. We won't make you do that on the spot, but just tell us a little bit. As the Father has sent me, so I send you. How does that work for the dust?
Yeah, I mean, that's the story, right? I mean, you've lived some of it. I was driving in a car on the way to work. Has been my habit just to pray. And one of the things, Bob, George, and I, we went to a conference. And what I came back from that is that God really desires, like, a real relationship with you. I've read it. But what was there is, you know, Adam and Eve, he was there walking in the cool of the day. He sent his son, Jesus Christ, to die for us for that relationship. And then he's going to be bringing his heaven on earth. It's all about that. The understanding. And so I was in the car and I was just praying. I says, God, I don't know what this is all about, but I give it to you. I give you my job, my finances. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do with my life? It was that afternoon that I got called in to the director's office and with my boss as well. And they shared with me, we'd just gone through a sale. And they said, you know, your salary is a little bit above what our budget is for, so you have 6 months to go find something else. So I'm praising God. I'm saying, okay, this is not my tent-making job, all right? Then for about 3 years after that, I've been working at a current employer, wondering and asking that same question. So, okay, God, I'm here, so now what do you want to do? And I was in a second car ride, so a car is very important to us, right? And I'm driving along, and I had received an email from a friend, John Ribley, and I had gone up to Canada and prayed for a group of guys at a conference. And one of those contacts would send us emails from time to time. We pray about them. But this one I really felt I needed to spend more time in, and so we did. So I made a couple of phone calls, and I'm praying in the car. Now I'm saying, God, they seem to want somebody up there at this camp. He says, what do I know about camping? I mean, I know something about project and business maybe, but camps, mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And I said, and what's more is they want a vision. I'm going, good grief, what kind of vision can I have a camp that I don't know and I don't know people, I don't know who it is. And it was really at that time, and all I can tell you is this is how it went down. I was driving along, it was raining, commute back home, and I opened up my portfolio on the right-hand side, and I started writing, and these thoughts just came streaming through. And it was about a camp in Canada that would trade out their facilities to evangelistic groups throughout for the 2010 Olympics. And in return, we would develop this year-round youth outreach training center. I go, whoa, okay. This is way outside my comfort zone. The call that I had scheduled for the next day was with the guy who is the chair of Keats Camps. It's where we're going. And by the way, he happened to be the chair of the 2010 Brigham to Olympics. They have already maneuvered and said, okay, let's do this thing. And I think one of the biggest confirmations for me is when we were with the board of directors and we were actually asked to take the job, the interim director said, so where have you been this last year? Because they had an 8-page document of what they were looking for. Not one item was ever mentioned about a camp director. The 8 pages, we looked around, he says, that's me. That's who God is doing. So 18-month search, here we are. And the answer is, we're just living life. We didn't know. Just normal stuff, fishing, right? That's counting right. Fish, bring them out. But that's where we're at. So on June 18th, we're going to be on island, and we begin this adventure. And I don't know where it's going to go. Each day brings something new, but we're trusting God for the whole deal.
And you know what's fun? You didn't chronicle exactly how much time, but lots of this has been years.
Totally.
So it's sometimes very sudden. I don't know how long it took Abram, and there's another person in that story, Sarah. There's another person, or four others in your story.
Yeah.
Carol, it's a Sarah moment, I guess, in some ways for you. It's
a series of Sarah moments, actually. Yeah. Actually, early on, the whole thing seemed so improbable that we had kind of, I don't know, almost a good time obeying, if that makes sense. God would bring something up, and we'd do it. Next step, next step, next step. And there was an excitement in it because, wow, there's this thing that makes no sense. From the very beginning, it felt like a God thing because it made, some ways, no sense, and yet there was that sense that we were being led. There was a night where I couldn't sleep, and lying in bed, and I was thinking about this path we'd been on, and the gravity of it hit me, because we're Americans, and we're talking Canada. and living on a little island for 2 months of every summer called Keats Island. And I've got family here, and I've got dear friends. And I saw where the path was had been and kind of where it was going. And out loud, Greg's a sound sleeper, I said into the darkness, "Oh, Lord, surely not." It's like, are you kidding me? And after that, it got a little hard because suddenly the gravity again was a problem. Here's how gracious God is. Only a month ago, we got the contract on a Friday, had to have it signed by a Monday. So that weekend was just wrestling. Greg was in a good place. Greg's been running along, and I feel like I've been loping along trying to catch up because he really has spent a lot of time with the Lord asking questions of God, what do you want to do with my life? And I wanted to be the partner that could go with him. But here was this weekend, and Greg was gracious enough to whiteboard things for me and write them down and pragmatic things. And I was concerned about our kids and how they'd fit. And boy, we wrestled a lot of prayer that weekend, and I cried. And finally, 12:40 on Sunday night, actually Monday morning, I just surrender. Surrender is where everything starts. Surrender. And at that point, Greg looked at me and said, "Will you cannonball with me?" And the analogy we'd been doing the whole time was this diving board. Jump off, cannonball, you know. Let's just go for it. Cold water underneath. And the other kind of person is the one that goes in very gradually with their arms up, you know, avoiding contact until the last possible minute where you've got to get your extremities in there. And that was me. And so when he said, "Will you cannonball with me?" I thought, yeah, I'll get up there with you. But I had a hard time getting up mentally on the diving board. And I thought I can do the leap, but that cold water. But yet, Lord, I'm going to follow you because I know it's right. I don't want to live in a small story. There is a big picture world out there. And we are in such a big picture, and we tend to live our lives in little small segments and content ourselves with that. And I can see the big picture, and I want to be part of that vision. So gritting my teeth, I'm going to cannonball with you. But here's what God did. We signed the contract, and I felt like we did it as an us. And later, just a few minutes later, I was picturing myself jumping in the cold water underneath. And instead of cold water, the Lord replaced that image with himself. I have Jesus now in my head, and I'm jumping off this diving board, and he's smiling, and you've all seen the dads in the pool that are going, "Come on, you know, a little scared kid, I'll catch you. Come on." And that's what Jesus was doing. And when I jumped, he caught me. And again, I've got these big warm arms around me, really strong image. And he's saying to me, actually, he's not saying anything. He's just laughing. And then, and then I have, again, a picture of him kind of holding me away from him for a moment. So we have eye contact, the two of us. And he's got all this warmth and humor in his eyes. And it's very steadying. And then he pulls me close again, and he just holds me. And so I thought, thank you, Lord. The cold water of leaving my friends and leaving familiarity. I like familiarity. Canada's far away. Not so far that you can't come visit us. but that was God's graciousness. Mm. So I don't know if it's easier to be Abraham or Sarah, but I'm really grateful that God has chosen really very ordinary people.
That's right.
To do something.
You know, along with the dusk, this isn't just a Duskin story. If their kids were, you know, of the persuasion to hold a microphone, they'd tell you their own piece of it. But John Rively, you've been mentioned a couple of times. I want you to just tell us, there's a widening story here, and just give us like a one-minute version, if you could, of the I want to call it the spring break weekend. I don't know, maybe that's the piece you want to mention, but there were a bunch of people that went up there.
About 20 of us went up over spring break to Keats Camp. We got to see the camp. We got to pray with Greg and Carol and paint ceilings and clear trails and burn brush and ride mountain bikes and explore the island. And it's a real great experience to picture them there obeying God. A lot of potential there. What's impressed me as Greg has let me walk along with him is that they are saying yes. And it's kind of, in my mind, Carol is using pictures, but if the IndyCar drivers suddenly started inviting passengers, and Greg and Carol have strapped themselves in and and they're, you know, leaving the starting line and racing towards that first corner, what's impressed me is they're not grabbing the wheel and they're not stomping on the brake. But the whole point is it's not about Greg and Carol. You know, if their car won and all the reporters glommed onto the passenger and, you know, tell me how it was, and they ignore the driver, you would think that there's something wrong. And the whole point here is, you know, God is building these relationships, working these details, all of these things to bring people to him so that we can reflect back to him his glory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just real excited to see somebody who's willing to accept God's invitation to that adventure, you know, let me send you.
As the Father has sent me, so I send you. I'm going to invite, if you were part of the spring break crowd, could you come up right now? Just kind of on the spot. I don't know how many are actually in here. But we're going to pray for them right now. And then there's a really cool song that ties all this together called Life Song that'll be sung for us. A few anyway. What were there, 20? Some 20 of them? Yeah, all right. All right.